So good morning, everyone, and welcome to this session, which is on reappointment. And before I'm going to start, I'm Lydia White, and I'm going to start with a presentation, a sort of general presentation about the reappointment process. And then we're going to have a panel, and I'll introduce them to you now. So Tim Moore is the chair of geography, and he will give you a departmental perspective. Chris Manfredi is Dean of Arts, and he'll give you a faculty perspective. Natalie Cook is one of the associate provosts, and she'll give you the perspective from the provost's office. And Cynthia Weston is from Teaching and Learning Services, and she will talk particularly about the teaching portfolio. So now I'm going to ask the faculty to move, panel to move for the time being so that you can see the slides. As far as I'm concerned, I'm happy to take interruptions during the presentation, or we can wait till afterwards, or we can do both. We've certainly planned for time for questions, and I think if your questions are questions of substance, I would actually wait until we've all presented, because I think some of your questions will probably be answered later in the course of the presentation. So the point of this session is to go over reappointment procedures. And some of what we're discussing today is in the regulations relating to the employment of academic staff. But the regulations as currently worded actually say very little about reappointment. This is one of the reasons for holding this session. I'm working on introducing changes to make the process more explicit. So these regulations are available on the Secretariat website. And by the way, these slides will be posted there as well. And the live stream apparently will be, if you wanted to watch this all over again, or you know people who might want to see it, it will be available for quite a long time. So in the context of reappointment, we're really talking about only two of the three ranks. That is to say, assistant professors who will go through a reappointment consideration, and associate professors who were appointed without tenure. Full professors appointed without tenure do not, they go straight to a tenure process, so we won't be talking about them. And the year of reappointment consideration is the third year of your initial appointment. So let's just talk about who will be considering your reappointment. So there'll be consideration at the departmental level, and departments have reappointment committees. In some departments it's the same as their tenure committee, in others it's not. And this committee is typically chaired by the chair of the department or director of school or institute if you're in those circumstances. The next level up, your dossier is considered, or your case is considered by the dean of the faculty, and in some cases the deans may actually have a faculty committee that is looking at reappointments. And then it goes up again, and the next level and the final level is the provost or his delegate. So those are the three levels that you will be considered by when you get to your reappointment. If you're in, have a joint appointment in two departments, the idea is that both departments contribute to the discussion, the decision, and so on. So there's one committee with representation from both the departments, and the chairs of the departments agree on who is going to chair that committee. And if there are two faculties involved, the deans have to make a joint recommendation. You can't have one dean saying yes and another dean saying no, for example. Now, you all should have received, within 60 days of your initial appointment, The criteria for reappointment within your unit, obviously criteria are not, I can't give you across the board, across the university criteria, but your unit, and if your unit hasn't given this to you, go straight to your chair after this meeting. And it's important that you know that your dean will already have seen these criteria and will have agreed that they are appropriate for the faculty in question. So here are the kinds of things that your department, the dean, and the provost will be looking at as far as reappointment is concerned. And the major thing is the performance of your academic duties. So that's what we're going to consider in a moment in more detail. But at the level of reappointment, promise is an important consideration. Do you show promise of meeting the tenure criteria? We're not expecting you at reappointment to already meet criteria for tenure, because if you did, you could go up for early tenure. But you need to show promise, and you need to show progress so that you're on track for tenure consideration, which for the mandatory year of tenure consideration is your sixth year. So let's talk about academic duties, because these are crucial. First of all, academic duties are assigned by your chair or director, the head of your unit. And criteria for both reappointment and tenure are based on those academic duties and how you are performing in them. So there are sort of three broad categories: teaching, for example, undergraduate teaching, graduate teaching, supervision, and many other things which perhaps Cynthia will talk about a bit more as to what you can include under teaching. Obviously, your research and other scholarly activities, original scholarly activities, creative activities if you're in certain disciplines, and some professional activities, and then other contributions which many of us refer to as service, but that word is not used in any of the regulations. So it's very important that you realize that you are responsible for preparing your case and pursuing your case. Don't wait for your chair to come and say, have you thought about your reappointment dossier? Have you thought about this, that, and the other? I mean, some departments will have mentoring systems or annual meetings with your chair, but ultimately the responsibility is yours. So don't wait to be approached. So you'll need to establish, for the satisfaction of the various levels of review, that you've met the requirements for reappointment and that you've put together a suitable dossier. What should the dossier consist of? Now, on the one hand, so let me make it clear, this is not your tenure dossier yet, but you should be sort of thinking of the tenure dossier so you can be building on whatever you put together for reappointment and expand it into the tenure dossier. So it makes sense to organize the dossier in terms of those categories that will be important for tenure. But as I think Chris Manfredi is going to say, you can be a lot briefer than you are in the tenure dossiers, and in my opinion, the tenure dossiers should be a lot briefer than they have become, but that's another matter. So, crucially, make sure you have a CV in your dossier. Keep this make sure it's up to date, and sort of one of my tips, which I will probably mention again later, keep your CV up to date all the time. Every time you go and present at a conference, put it into your CV. Don't wait till the third year when you're trying to put this together and trying to remember, what did I do 2 years ago? Keep everything, keep running track of what you're doing. Then you need some part of the dossier, the reappointment dossier, that focuses on your research and related activities, so you know, a statement of what your research is aimed at, some record of your research. Units will vary as to how much they want you to include in the way of actual examples of papers. Your teaching portfolio, I won't say much about this because Cynthia Weston will be talking about this, but the current regulations have an appendix on the teaching portfolio. Again, it seems to be perhaps overly demanding in terms of the documentation that's asked for, and we're working on not reducing the importance of teaching, but reducing the amount of electronic paper that you need to submit to support your teaching component. And then a statement of description of what you've been doing in the way of service. So let me just go through some sample timetables, because we often get questions about when is my reappointment consideration, when is my tenure consideration. So what I'm going to do is give you just a few examples, assuming a particular start date for your initial appointment, a particular end date. So given the start date and the end date, when is your year of reappointment consideration, when is your year of tenure consideration? Let me point out that this is possibly confusing. For reappointment consideration, you need to think about the end date of your first appointment. But for tenure consideration, you need to think about the starting date, or at least the starting year of your initial appointment. So this may become clearer with examples. So supposing you have an appointment that started on August the 1st last year. It's a three-year appointment, so it'll end July 31st, 2014. So your year of reappointment consideration will be the year prior to the third year of that appointment, counting backwards from July 2014. But your year of tenure consideration is always calculated from the calendar year, in fact, June 1st, of the calendar year of your first appointment. So it would be 2016-2017. So notice, here's another example where the date of the initial appointment is January 2011, last year. So your initial appointment is going to end 3 years later. So your year of reappointment consideration is different from the previous example. It's your third year. But your year of tenure consideration is the same, because it's the calendar year 2011 that's crucial in determining this. And here's another example. What happens if you were appointed towards the end of last year, say? Then you have a three-year appointment. So again, your year of reappointment consideration depends on whatever your final initial appointment date was, but your year of tenure consideration is the same. So this is just something to bear in mind, especially a few years down the road when you're wondering when is your year of mandatory tenure consideration. Always look to the calendar year of your initial appointment. Reappointment is somewhat simpler. It's your third year. So just to, I won't go through this in any detail, but it's just to let you know, let's take the top example. What is happening during your year of reappointment consideration? So let's say your appointment ends on January 31st, 2 years down the road. About a year earlier, your dossier should be ready to submit to your department, because they will have to start considering your dossier, and indeed they'll have to make a recommendation to the dean within a couple of months, so 2 to 3 months of receiving your dossier, and the dean only has about a month. This is if people are not preparing in advance of deadlines to submit to the provost office. And then a month after that, you'll be getting a decision from the provost office. So we talk about a whole year of reappointment consideration, but it's actually the first half of that year where everything is happening. There are certain cases where these things change. So if you've had can change, let me make it clear in the case of reappointment consideration that this is not automatic. But if you've had an authorised leave, maternity leave, for example, leave of absence, disability leave, of longer than 3 months, you can request a postponement of reappointment consideration, and this will be considered. You need to make such requests, you know, not later than the beginning of your third year, so that the unit and those higher know whether or not you're going to be considered in that year. And if the request is granted, then there can be an extension of your initial appointment for up to 1 year, and reappointment consideration can be postponed accordingly. But it's not, unlike for tenure, where it's pretty much automatic, for reappointment we do actually consider these on a case-by-case basis. If this happens to you and you are granted an extension, this will also affect your year of tenure consideration, and you will be so informed. Okay, let's just talk about some possible outcomes of the reappointment process. So where your departmental committee or the dean or the provost is what's called tending towards a negative, there are various things that must be done so that you can present your case. So the first thing is, the first thing is that you need to be advised in writing what the concerns are so that you know what the issue is. And you need to be given a reasonable time to prepare a response. And I'm often asked, what is a reasonable time? I would say 2 weeks. But sometimes everything's very tight, and sometimes you may, if you ask for more than 2 weeks, this may be difficult. If you're available in less than 2 weeks, this is great. There is no written definition of reasonable here. You must be given the opportunity to address the concerns of whoever it is who has concerns in person, and you are allowed an advisor of your choice who has to be a member of the McGill community, not paid for your advice, their advice, etc. Now, if you're not recommended for reappointment, your appointment may continue for up to 1 year. The issue is whether or not you've been given 37 weeks prior notice. And if this happens, that is to say you are not recommended for reappointment, you have the right to appeal, and there's a whole set of regulations and procedures about that. But let me make it clear, most of you will not be in that situation. And even if you are, it's don't sort of give up if you get an indication, say, from your committee that they're tending to a negative. There are many cases where the candidate appears before the committee and is able to persuade them that tending to a positive is a better result than tending to the negative. So it's not it's not an empty issue. You can appear and you can persuade the committees. Again, continuing with outcomes, if everything is, as far as all levels consider, completely on track for tenure, your reappointment would be for 3 years. If at any level there have been concerns, perhaps in just one area or more, and these concerns are agreed to by all levels, then your reappointment might be shorter than 3 years, it might be 1 year or 2 years. And notice that if this is the case, you actually have to be reconsidered for reappointment when that shorter appointment term, well, before it comes to an end, a year before it comes to an end. One really important takeaway message here is plan ahead. Don't wait till the last minute, like, you know, 1 month before the beginning of your third year to put your dossier together. Start working on it now. And remember, you're going to be able to use it and build on it for tenure as well. Don't be afraid to ask for advice. Your colleagues who've recently been through it, your chair, other people that you know, lots of people will have sensible advice about things that you might be worried about. And I'm here, and sometimes when I can get into my office in the James Building, I'm there. And so please feel free to email me if there's anything, any help you want with interpreting the regulations. So at this point, I'll ask if there are any... let's say we won't take questions now. We'll wait for the individual presentations, unless there's a sort of factual question that anyone would like. But I think the more general questions are, it's going to make more sense to hear the panel. So, yes. Can you put your speaker on?
Sure. I'm wondering if a template is available for the CV, indicating the order in which items should appear so that we all have the same... looking like CV.
You turn off your mic, and I'm going to ask Natalie Cook to talk about something that's in the long-term pipeline. The current answer is no. Right. There isn't a template, but the university's working on a project to sort of make this kind of thing happen. Natalie,
would I like to? Maybe not, but... I'm about to press send on a memo today asking deans to ask faculty members to send their CVs. At the moment, we don't actually have a central repository for all the faculty CVs. So if somebody says, look, we're looking for somebody for a particular award, it's very difficult for us to find information. So I'm going to ask to faculty members to send CVs in any format at this point. But we are working on... what we call the common CV, because those of you who've applied for grants probably know the endless frustration in having to input CV information into different formats, including one that's called the common CV that isn't, so that they can spit it out in the particular format that the various Tri-Council grants want. So it's a bit of an elusive goal, but we think we're within about a year or two of having that. And at that point, we'll have this common template. So we're waiting until we have this one, because it could be updated relatively easily if we can get it online. So we're just keep your fingers crossed. An excellent question.
In the meantime, I would suggest that you might want to at least talk to your chair, or in the department or in the discipline, is there a particular way of organizing your CV? Because I think, you know, you've raised a very important issue. How can you, you're in, to some extent doing a selling job. How can you present yourself in the best possible way? And sometimes the CVs are very confusing. So until we come up with some sort of template, if we do so, I think it's a good idea to ask around.
I wanted to ask about what unit means. I did get the reappointment criteria letter from the dean, which reproduced the generic information on the web. And I asked my chair, who's a director, and she said there won't be any more coming. That's it. And you seem to indicate a more specific written criteria list.
Yes, I mean the academic unit. So it depends if you're in a faculty without departments.
Faculty with departments.
Faculty with departments. I suggest you email me and we talk about this, because your chair or there should have been. If it's a faculty with departments, when I say unit, I mean departments or schools or mm-hmm. institutes, people with units with a teaching as well as a research component. But I think this is going to be too specific. So please email me and we can talk about this. Any other?
Yes, you mentioned that as part of the planning process for the reappointment is sitting down with a mentor, discussing different things. And, I mean, most of us have good relationship with the mentor. We discuss general things. But is the mentor somebody with whom you would sit down with your CV, with your dossier, count beans with them, make sure that you're in a good standing. I mean, most of us would say, well, I think I'm okay, but unless somebody comes and looks at all of this information, they won't really be able to give me concrete advice. Is this something we do with a mentor or...
I think this depends on your, you know, who you have a mentoring relationship with, what kinds of things you talk about. The other thing is, you could indeed talk to your chair. Your chair is in a kind of wearing two hats. You know, on the one hand, that you are in their department, they were instrumental in appointing you in the first place. And guiding you through, and on the other hand, they end up chairing various committees. But I think most chairs are pretty good at balancing those hats. So if I were you, I would not just rely on a mentor, especially if your mentor happens to be in a different department, which might have different requirements. Talk to your chair first, and if the chair feels that they're in a conflict of interest, then they might suggest somebody in the department to talk to. Talk about the departmental aspects of reappointment.
Thank you, Lydia. So I'm chair of geography, which is a medium-sized department in the Faculty of Science, about 20-odd faculty. And we're a mixture of both natural scientists, physical geographers like myself, but also faculty who work in the social sciences and humanities. So we have quite a diverse collection of individuals that we have to try and evaluate both for the merit process in terms of salary, but also in terms of both reappointment and tenure. We also have quite a few joint appointments, and so again, we have to be fairly flexible in the way in which we run things. So I'd just like to have five major points, which I think have some resonance to the slides that Lydia showed you. Firstly, I think that the absence of regulations, as people say it's delightfully vague, is a good thing. Because if you look at the university as a whole, there's a tremendous range of individuals and different expectations and aspirations across the university, and therefore you don't want very specific sets of regulations in terms of criteria. And I hope that if we do have a templated CV, I shall be retired by then, because again, I think that a CV is a very good expression of the individual, and I would hope that that won't become too regimented in this process. Second point I want to make is that, going back to slide 7, the real two things here are promise and progress. I mean, promise got you the job in the tenure-track position in the department. Progress is now what we're doing after 2 years or 3 years to see how far you're going to wait to fulfilling that progress, that promise, rather, which will get you tenure. So this is a sort of check on that. I think that's very important to realize then that it is an assessment of the progress of fulfilling that promise. I think, to go back to the questions, is that it is really a very short period of time upon which you're being evaluated. It's essentially 2 years, 2 years and a day maybe. For example, we have an appointment in geography this year who was appointed on June the 1st. The 2 years will be up on May the 31st. We have to get the letter to the dean with the recommendation by July the 15th, which of course is midsummer. So if you back up that time, it means that I have to send to the applicant then, last week, a request for the dossier by May the 31st. It will then be reviewed by our committee, in fact a joint appointment, which makes it doubly difficult to try and get people together, by June the 15th. And again, if we're tending towards a negative decision, then we also have to give time to be able to invite the candidate to meet with the committee. So it really is a very short period of time. Short period of time from your point of view, of adjusting to a new institution, new colleagues, new way of doing things perhaps. And from the department point of view, it's also we're dealing with a very limited amount of information to be able to access progress. So obviously you've been teaching, but in many cases the teaching load is reduced in the first year. So you may be dealing with somebody who's taught perhaps only three or four courses over the two-year period. You've gone through two cycles of grant proposals, if you were, for example, in NSERC or SHRC in the fall. So there's some assessment about one's ability to generate research funds. Unless you're very, very quick on the uptake, again, you only have the opportunity to bring in new graduate students in the beginning of the second year. And again, they will be just finishing their first year of progress. And so again, it's very difficult to see how there can be a substantial complement of graduate student supervision that's been developed. Likewise, in terms of service, certainly in our department, we don't expect a lot of service from the individuals in the department. We don't give them major responsibilities. And so, again, it's not easy to assess those things. So I do agree with Lydia that it is a short period of time. You have to keep things up to date and you have to submit them. But also recognize the fact, from our point of view, we're only basing it on 2 years of progress over that period of time, which is really not very long. The fourth point I want to raise is that it's about outcomes. For example, we can recommend that the candidate revise the dossier before it goes to the dean. In the case of tenure, if you remember, in fact, the dossier goes to the secretariat first, and therefore there's no real opportunity for revision. But in some cases, we've had the opportunity to make the dossier clearer by taking the comments of the committee before it gets to the dean. I think also there's an opportunity for feedback in the letter. Again, the letter goes from the committee to the dean. It's fairly informal compared to the more formal process that goes through the tenure process, but again, an opportunity to give encouragement and to give support and give recommendations to the individual candidate as they go through to the tenure process, which is essentially 5 years later. And finally, I think there's very strong empirical evidence from me being at McGill for decades that the quality of a candidate is inversely proportional to the length of the dossier. If you get a big fat one, you know they're in trouble. If you get a nice thin one, you're pretty sure that person is very high quality and you should keep them.
Are there any questions at this point from the departmental level? Okay, if not, thank you very much, Tim. We'll have Chris Manfredi, Dean of Arts, to talk about a dean's perspective.
Thanks, Lydia. Very pleased to be here. I really have only three things that I want to do. First of all, I'll say a little bit about how this works in the Faculty of Arts. And I think it's probably similar to all the large faculties that have departments. Smaller faculties without departments will be different. In the Faculty of Arts, as Lydia pointed out, it's a faculty where in the Faculty of Science, where the departmental decision goes up to a committee chaired by the dean. In the case of the Faculty of Arts, it's something called the Faculty Review Board, which is a committee of full professors that the dean chairs, and it makes the recommendation that then goes on to the provost. And I assume that large faculties like science operate similarly. Really, three points that I want to make. One is, this is not the tenure decision. It's not a decision as to whether you have achieved the requirements that are set out in the regulations with respect to research, teaching, and service, namely that you have achieved superior performance in two and at least reasonable in the third. It is a decision about whether you are making progress towards, as Tim said, whether you're making progress towards meeting those criteria. So it's, in some sense, the stakes aren't quite as high in that case, or at least the bar isn't quite as high. It's about whether there's been progress towards the promise that you demonstrated to get the job in the first place, as Tim mentioned. So that's the first point I want to make. The second point I want to make is that it is really a diagnostic and mentoring moment in two directions. It's a diagnostic and mentoring moment to the candidate, both as they come up through the department and then as the decision from the faculty committee, in our case, goes back down. It's also a diagnostic and mentoring moment to the department. So let me try to elaborate on that. First of all, the faculty committee, at least, has an opportunity to make recommendations to both the candidate and the department as to things that to which attention might be paid as the career continues towards the tenure decision. Sometimes, for example, the faculty committee may be a little bit surprised at the high level of administrative responsibilities that are being heaped upon a junior faculty member, and that might be affecting their ability to perform in other areas of their academic duties. And so sometimes that may be a signal sent down to the department that they should watch that out. It's also a way of setting some expectations for candidates. And some of these expectations are ones that the candidate will signal him or herself. If, for example, the candidate says, my expectation is that in the next 3 years I will publish a book, the faculty committee will acknowledge that and set it down, and that will be an expectation when one comes up for tenure. So if you've promised to do that, and it's not there when one comes up for tenure, that's not such a good thing. So it's a way of putting on the record expectations that the committee will that will be examined as one comes up. But again, so it's a diagnostic moment. What is going well about this trajectory? What might not be going so well, both in terms of what the department is demanding as well as what the candidate is putting forward? And it's a mentoring moment to try to help people understand what it is they have to do in their career to succeed. The third point I want to make, and it plays off the last point Tim made, clarity and conciseness are the two most important things. I guess I have a slightly different view about common CVs and the clarity of CVs than Tim does. It's astonishing to me how many files we still see which contain CVs that do not clearly present what the candidate has accomplished so far. Confusion, lack of clarity, things not properly labeled. The most important document in that reappointment dossier is your CV, and it needs to be clear. I'm not sure we need a complete, a total template, but I think there's a very clear way of categorizing things in your CV and of presenting them in a logical order. I think my own CV does a pretty good job of doing that. So if anyone in the Faculty of Arts wants to see what a social scientist CV that I think actually is clear in terms of categorizing things and presenting them in a logical order, I'd be happy to share at least the categories with you. And conciseness. It's not a tenure dossier. And even, as Lydia said, some tenure dossiers are getting too large. It's really just providing information about what has been accomplished and what will be accomplished in the next 3 years. Fortunately, in the Faculty of Arts, we've seen a tendency towards smaller reappointment dossiers, and I think that's continuing. But the idea is to just simply give the committee clear, concise information about what has happened since your appointment and the trajectory you believe you are on. And that's what we're looking for. And I will just echo one last point that Lydia says. It is not a process that's designed to weed people out. It really is a process to diagnose issues that may be arising and to mentor you to make sure that you are being successful in your academic career. So that's it.
Are there any questions for Chris Manfredi at this point?
I'm trying to understand your advice about setting expectations. So are you espousing the view that you like saying to game it? I'm trying to understand when you're saying
No, I'm saying that part of your reappointment dossier is this is what I've done, uh-huh. And this is my research agenda for the next little while. Uh-huh. And so you need to... So what we will look at is if you've set out an agenda, the reappointment process will acknowledge that that's what your agenda is, and it will become a benchmark to look back on at tenure.
So the common sense advice is to just be realistic about your expectations, but not to, neither to overstate them nor...
Well, but you also don't want to understate them, because if you set out very low, an indication of that your trajectory is below what we would expect of our people, and that you can tell, you can look at by look. So your each department, at least in the Faculty of Arts, and I assume in the faculty of other faculties with departments, and should be in faculties without departments, have criteria for reappointment and tenure. So part of what you're doing in your reappointment process is indicating how the trajectory you're on will get you to the criteria that have been set out for tenure. So if you've set out a trajectory that's going to fall short of that, that's when there's a problem. So you want to make sure that the trajectory you've set out is one that will meet the criteria that have been set out for tenure. And if it's going to fall short of that, that will be signaled to you. But we'll also acknowledge that this is what you've This is how you have said you will meet the requirements for tenure. And if you don't do that, then it becomes an issue, or it can become an issue.
Thank you.
So next, Natalie Cook will talk a little bit about, in a sense, the highest level that your dossiers get to, namely the provost's office.
I'm actually just going to make one point, and I want to emphasize Chris's notion of it being a mentoring and a diagnostic moment, but it's very much a moment in a process. And so we're talking about the particular moment now, but it gives you a chance to understand and to try and develop a network of wise counselors at McGill. In your PhD defense, you've had a chance to get, you know, a number of interesting minds to think about your topic and to have a discussion with you and to really spend, you know, probably a couple of hours trying to think through how to help you move your project forward. How could you better it? How could you take it in new directions? This is another moment where you can choose your counselors and your mentors to think about how to help you move your career forward. And it also gives you a chance to test out some mentors. And so you might actually want to speak to your peers and think about how to present the dossier. You have an opportunity because of the hiring in the last few years to talk to people who are probably a year or two ahead of you and say, how did it feel? You know, how did you go through the process? What would you have done differently? You know, learn from their advice. And take the counsel that you think is interesting and make some decisions, because you're going to be looking for your mentors for the next stage of the process as well. From the provost's office, we see two different pieces of information in addition to the dossier. We see the Department Tenure Committee's letter, which is usually quite long and very detailed and gives you some very interesting specific advice, and especially in faculties where there's a large faculties, we'll see a faculty letter, which probably isn't quite so long, but we'll try and emphasize the key points. And then the provost will actually send you a letter from the provost's office, which is going to be the shortest of all. But it will emphasize and re-emphasize the key points. So the messages coming through on the provost's letter are messages that we really want you to hear and pay attention to. And they're saying, please, please, look at these key issues as you're moving to tenure. So the first thing is, do look at that letter very carefully. A lot of time and energy goes into phrasing it and thinking through it. There are a couple of choices, as Lydia mentioned. You might be renewed for a year, or 2 years, or 3 years. If you are renewed for a year, it's a pretty strong signal, and it means that you do need to pay attention to the specific advice that's been given to you at each of those three levels, at the departmental tenure committee level, at the faculty level, and at the provost level. And they're giving specific advice. Everybody is there to help you, but it does mean you do need to pay attention to the letter pretty carefully.
Any questions for Natalie at this point? Okay, thanks very much. So the final panel member is Cynthia Weston from Teaching and Learning Services, who will be talking about the teaching aspects of your dossier.
A teaching dossier is one part of your portfolio. We've been talking this morning about the entire dossier that you'll be submitting for reappointment at McGill, which consists of the research component, the teaching component, which I'll talk about in a bit more detail, as well as the, what are we calling it? Not service, but not calling it service. The community, the service that we provide to the McGill community, as well as to the our academic community's community at large. The teaching portfolio has actually been required at McGill since 1994, and one of the reasons it was brought into being as a policy was to emphasize the importance of teaching at McGill and to bring it into part of our scholarly activity and to expand the ways that we document teaching. But one, I think one of the most important things was, if we think of it as part of our scholarship, how do we collect artifacts about our teaching? We know how to do that with research. We have our articles and our books and our conference presentations and many things that we do in that regard. But people often said, "But how do I capture, how do I document my effectiveness as a teacher?" That's what the teaching portfolio is really about. I'm just going to go over it really briefly today because the information is all on the web, the specific guidelines. So you can just go to TLS, Teaching and Learning Services, Teaching Portfolio, and you'll find the guidelines there. This is the basic structure of the teaching portfolio, and many people have often asked, and what's the structure for the research part of the service part of the portfolio? And in fact, we're working on clarifying that as well. But there is a very specific structure that's recommended, and we are working towards making it as concise as it can possibly be, because I understand these have kind of been expanding and getting out of hand. So it really, 5 to 10 pages, 10 would really be the max, trying to keep this short. And some people integrate it into their research statement, into their overall dossier statement, or they make it a separate component. There are different models. And we do have samples at TLS you can come to look at. But there are four things you want to be thinking about in terms of gathering your information and presenting your case about the teaching aspect of your responsibilities. Your teaching approach, your responsibilities, evidence of effectiveness, which is the one that people often wonder about the most. What are those artifacts I can put together? And any activities you might have been doing to develop your teaching. And if you have appendices, I mean, we say 30 pages maximum, but I think that's that really to try to keep that to a minimum. So the first thing to be thinking about, and how many of you have been here for a year or less? So we've got a few people who've been here for a year or less, and you may have had teaching experience before you came or not, but sometimes we don't stop to think about, why do I teach the way that I do? And that's part of stating your teaching approach. You know, how do I teach? And why do I teach in that way? And that's what people are trying to get a sense of from you is what's your rationale under the way that you teach. So that's something you might want to start making some notes about and thinking about. And teaching responsibilities, this is probably the most obvious one, making a list of your courses, making a list of your supervision activities, undergraduate, graduate students that you're supervising, theses, and so on. And again, these are all in the guidelines, so I'm just going through these quickly. The third piece is evidence of effectiveness. And you've all probably already getting teaching evaluations, or you're aware that there are course evaluations. Have you all received course evaluations so far? Any of you in your teaching? Not yet? Okay. Course evaluations are mandatory at McGill for all courses. However, during your first years of teaching, you can opt out of it often. But at reappointment, you probably will, at that point, have some course evaluations that you're going to want to summarize and interpret. And recently, actually, I think just last week, the guidelines for interpreting course evaluations were posted. Again, you go to TLS. Teaching and course evaluations interpretation will help you think through what do those course evaluations mean, what can I do in response to them. That's the next one. Is there something I should be doing, maybe some adjustments I could be making to my teaching? And so that's for your coursework, your teaching. And the second part would be evidence of supervision, effectiveness in supervision. And that is considered a teaching responsibility at McGill. Sometimes people wonder, is it teaching, is it research? But we do put it in the teaching category. You know, what students do you have? And how are you moving along in the promise and progress component of supervision? And then the last piece is teaching development, and I think that's probably going to be a piece that you've thought a little bit about if it's of concern to you. Have you been engaged in workshops or working with colleagues in the department? And this piece, I think Lydia's thinking, is a bit more optional at the reappointment time. So this has been said before, and we cannot emphasize it enough. you have to start gathering evidence now. You have to start gathering your materials now. We talk about a real shoebox, a virtual shoebox, however it is you want to do it. A chair of a department often has told me that he has his CV on his desktop. Every time he opens up his computer, his CV comes up so that he remembers to put down the last presentation he gave, the last conference, you know, the committees that he's on, the theses, that, and so on. So he says that was a way for him to keep track of things. But as Lydia and others have said, it's very hard to go back and try to remember all the things that you've done. And you do so much every month, every year. So do try to keep track of that, because then it becomes a much easier task to assemble it. And in terms of all of these aspects of the teaching portfolio, we do have a consultant at Teaching and Learning Services. She will work with all any of you individually. She would come and talk with departments if that's how you would prefer. Talk to you about interpreting your course evaluations. She would give you feedback on your teaching portfolio. And we do have a whole range of samples of portfolios that were submitted by profs who have received tenure at McGill in the last 5 to 7 years and within different disciplines. So then I'll turn it over to Lydia for, I think, questions at large. Unless there were any questions of clarification on this particular piece. Yeah.
Yes. I'm just curious about how one should present teaching that was done before arriving at McGill, and particularly if there are like students that you co-supervise but are not students at McGill, how those enter into this portfolio.
Well, I am going to ask the department and chair and the dean to weigh in on this as well, but in the number of committees that I've sat on, they have often said that what you've done before McGill sometimes isn't counted. So I think I'll turn it over to you to see what your take is on that. You can see this is very clear.
I think based upon the fact that we're evaluating you with only 2 years of experience at McGill, a knowledge of what you did before you came to McGill will be very useful. We already know that because we saw that in your dossier when we gave you the job in the first case, but it might be worthwhile reiterating the performance in the past. It will not help you, I don't think, at all in terms of the tenure process 3 years later on, but I think from our point, from the Department of Geography anyway, a brief resume of what went on before you came to McGill would help us to put into context the 2 years of performance that we have to deal with at McGill.
I think that's right. I think at the tenure process, it's very different. What you did before you got to McGill is the basis for hiring you. Tenure is granted on what you've done since McGill, unless except for a couple of exceptional circumstances, but that's the general rule. But nevertheless, at reappointment, having a bit more of a perspective on what happened before can help.
Can I follow up one thing, which I meant to say before? I think also in the process of looking at the reappointment, we're looking for you to essentially cleaved off from what you did in the past and establish yourself as an independent professor in a McGill setting. And again, to have that, what you did in the past, and now what you're doing at McGill, and to show the difference between the two, I think will be a very useful part of the dossier.
I'd just like to clarify something. So when Cynthia was talking in the earlier slides about the size of the dossier, the teaching portfolio, this is more for tenure. I just want to reiterate what Chris said, which is you do not need a big, fat dossier, and the teaching component does not need to be like that for reappointment. But you do need to cover, you know, the kinds of issues that Cynthia mentioned, but not at enormous length.
I just want to pick up from the point that Tim made about cleaving off from what you've done in the past. So, look, when you come up for reappointment, what are we, in a sense, what are we looking for? So you've got let's assume you're coming straight out of your PhD. You've got a dissertation and maybe some conference papers. Maybe you've got some publications as well. But so what we're looking at is, what progress have you been making in getting that work validated in the scholarly community through publication in refereed outlets? So you've got your dissertation, which has been validated as a dissertation, or your and other things. So what progress are you making towards having that validated by peers outside of your the actual granting of your degree? But secondarily, we're also looking at, what are you starting to think about in terms of moving on to your next research agenda? Because you can't simply be stuck in what you did to get your degree. So I don't know if that makes sense to you, Tim, in terms of a description of what it is we're kind of looking at.
In terms of expectations, then it would be very difficult to say, oh, I intend to take Chapter 5 in my thesis and submit it as a paper in the second 3 years at McGill, which is not something that you want to do. Essentially, you should have finished with all the things you did at either at the PhD or the postdoctoral level.
I should say, for reappointment, it's actually not, I mean, it's better if those things are starting to be published, but, you know, evidence that they've been submitted, that they're under review, that they're revised and resubmit, because we all know there's a time lag in getting things published, but we want to see that you've got material that you're submitting for recognition and verification by your peers. By the time you get the tenure, of course, we're going to want to see that you've got that recognition and verification and that you're moving on, I think.
And just one addition there, in the STEM disciplines, we're looking for some sense that you're developing an independent research program. And so trying to see how you are developing a trajectory that's independent from that of your supervisor. And that will be happening as you're at McGill. And we know it takes time. So at the reappointment stage, we're really just looking for indications about how that's starting to happen. By tenure, we'll be seeing your own independent trajectory at that point.
James Colton, professor in Department of Microbiology and Immunology in the Faculty of Medicine. I've made many notes here about CVs. Having endured the reappointment process in 1981, my CV must have been very thin because I couldn't find it in my filing cabinet. It would have been paper, and that would have subscribed to one of the requests here. I did hear a reference to a McGill template CV, perhaps, something that would standardize activities and reporting. May I have further clarification of that, Natalie?
When you say template CV, it's not actually a template CV. The CASRAE has been an organization in existence for, 10 years now? You're probably familiar with it.
And sorry, what does that stand for?
I can't do the acronym, but it's a consortium of universities and the Tri-Council agencies who've been working to develop a common CV that would really be a common CV so that you could put in information about publications once, and then you could press a button and say, let's print it out for NSERC or for CIHR or for SHRC. So it's definitely not a template. In fact, if you think about the range and variety across McGill, I mean, having a one-size-fits-all CV would, I think, be give us a diminished sense of the range and the value of individual careers. So it's definitely not a template. It was a way of trying to optimize what is currently called the common CV and is being used on the various Tri-Council agencies, but is incredibly frustrating. Those of us in Quebec know that you have to put in information at least twice if you're applying provincially and federally, and you have to update your both CVs simultaneously as well as the CV sitting on your computer?
I have 5 copies of my CV. There's the common CV, which can be formatted for different agencies. There's the NSERC CV. I'm hearing about the Manfredi CV. Perhaps this is on the web, and we could have some viewing. I have a personal CV, many pages, and the Faculty of Medicine had its own CV template within recent times. Does this still exist, and is this an expectation of the Provost's Office, this Faculty of Medicine CV?
It's not an expectation of the Provost's Office. The Faculty of Medicine actually has a very helpful CV template that they request, and so we are familiar with seeing it. We've obviously, Faculty of Medicine is a large faculty, so we are very familiar with how to read it and see it, and the Faculty of Medicine is very good at reviewing its own reappointment dossiers.
Is that an expectation for this process, the completion of the Faculty of Medicine's CV template?
For the Faculty of Medicine, it is an expectation of the process.
Therefore, that's a duplication of what you're espousing here, which is a minimum amount of paper. There's the Faculty of Medicine's CV that needs to be completed, and there is something which is succinct, Manfredi style.
Mine's not very succinct. It's just clear.
I see. We're for clarity as well in the Faculty of Medicine.
The Faculty of Medicine is the only faculty that actually has a template.
Wouldn't know it.
So, I think when Chris was talking about his CV, he was talking, offering it up for the Faculty of Arts, especially in response to a question which said, do you have a suggestion for, you know, a good CV template? Was that right?
Yeah, I'm happy to share mine.
So just to be clear, then the candidate is expected in the reappointment process to complete the Faculty of Medicine's CV template and to complete something which is different?
I mean, I don't know if Natalie wants to answer this, but you know, we're not asking people in the reappointment or tenure process to produce 2 different CVs. If a faculty happens to have, and medicine is the only one, a way that they like candidates to prepare their CVs at the faculty level, that's the one that can come up to the Provost's Office. You don't have to prepare a different one for the other levels. So, there are departments and faculties that will may add... it's not exactly adding a requirement, but it's a sort of recommendation that everyone do it this way. We're not, at the university level, the top level, we're not saying, don't do it that way, do it this way. So whatever comes up from the department, then to the faculty, comes up to the Provost's Office. So one CV is definitely enough.
So the Faculty of Medicine has solved the problem that I discussed by having a CV template, and that works for the Faculty of Medicine, and that's fine. And you've obviously got a template that allows the necessary information to be communicated clearly and concisely to the people who have to make this decision, department chairs, dean, and the provost. Other faculties don't have that. The basic issue, of course, is that there are different... The most frustrating thing is to get a CV where different kinds of publications are all jumbled up together under a single category, and it's very difficult to sort through, first of all, refereed from non-refereed, articles from technical notes, etc., clarification on who, numbers of authors, first author, and things like that. That kind of information often is presented in CVs in a way that makes it difficult for the various levels to understand what it is precisely the candidate has produced.
I have a question regarding the teaching, the point number 3, the evidence of effectiveness. And I mean, when I think about effectiveness of the teaching, I mostly think about the learning outcomes, how much of the class actually learned the skill or the material that you were presenting in class. But then you mostly mention the course evaluations, which I have course evaluations. They're not that good. But at the same time, is there another measure, another way of showing that, well, all this time that we're putting in into designing this course, the only reflection is not what the students think of us, because we think they're actually learning, whether or not they have another opinion about how the course was delivered or given.
Yes, there are definitely other things that you can use. And if we, actually, I think we may have a link here to the internet. I don't know. In any case, you can look at the guidelines, and it does give some ideas. But let me just tell you what some others have done. Some people do include their course outlines, but including it without an explanation of what it is that you want people to look at is not very helpful. So if you include it, you want to help people see what it is that you've been designing in that learning activity, you know, a brief statement that helps them to focus on your learning outcomes or how you're evaluating learning and what you've seen in the evaluation of learning. So that's one thing that people include. Another thing that people sometimes include are actually examples of work that students have done. Now, you don't want a lot of it, but you might have one or two excerpts where you show, you know, I was trying to develop critical thinking. Here's an example of the kind of thinking that I've been trying to develop. So you definitely, you know, I really take your point on how important it is to try to show what you see happening in your students' learning. You get students' opinions from the course evaluations and their experience of the learning, but then you're also wanting to present your own experience of it. So those are two examples, and certainly if you communicate with us or with Susan Cowan, we can talk to you about some other ones as well. And you may, and there may be some other ideas here from others. Does that give you some possibilities?
Just a brief question. If it's so important to have students' evaluations, why are they not made mandatory? Because most of the time, they are not statistically representative. The outcome, you know, if you have 50 students and you get 10 who fill out the student evaluations, but it's very important for my reappointment and tenure dossier. So can you comment on that?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, we have Laura Weiner here, who's been leading the project on doing an in-depth analysis of statistical analysis of course evaluations and also developing the guidelines. So Laura, would you like to respond to that?
I would encourage you to look at the guidelines that were just posted, because we did in-depth analysis, statistical analysis of McGill responses for the past, well, not the past 2 years, 2008, 2009, and 9 and 10, and they actually are representative in the vast majority of cases, and there's more detail than I can imagine you would want in the guidelines and reports of analyses we did. So I think the issue of mandatory is, if you make something mandatory, what quality of information are you going to get? There is no evidence to suggest that there is a non-representative sample of students responding. So I would encourage you to look at the guidelines, and then feel free to contact me.
With regards to the statistical analysis, would it be possible for us to be part of the analysis at some level, get access to that data? Because I don't know how rigorous the analysis is being conducted. We would like to know how you're proving that the rate of survey response is not correlated with the evaluations. I mean, if you have 50 students, it's probable that the 10 students who have replied are those who have a problem with the course, and the rest of the 40 did not have any problem and they never responded. So
this is fully reported in the guidelines, so I'd encourage you to look at those first, and if following that you have questions, please feel free to contact me.
Thank you so much.
I have one comment or question. To me, comments of the students in the course of evaluations are probably equally or probably more important than the actual statistical taking of 3 out of 5, whatever it is. Is there a policy about the citing of comments in teaching dossiers? Is it one? Can you do all of them? Do you have to do all of them? Or?
It has to be one intact set, meaning an intact set from a single course. I mean, it could be multiple intact sets, although depending on how large a course is, that could get to be quite long, but it can't be selected comments. It has to be an intact set.
Uh, what do you mean by an intact set? I mean, if I have a class of 100, how would you represent that?
You would present the comments from all 100 students as they printed out. And
can I just,
Laura?
Yeah, there has been an issue recently because with the online system, students tend to write much more extensive comments. And there are cases in large classes where you do run into a problem of, you know, 47 pages of comments if you print them all out. It doesn't have to be, first of all, it doesn't have to be an intact set of comments for all of the questions. So in other words, you would take the core questions or a specific question that's of relevance and give the intact set of comments for that question. We did have a case where somebody was teaching a class of 300 where the set of comments was 24 pages or something. And what she did was categorize them, give a sense, do an analysis of there were this many that addressed this issue, this many that addressed that issue. And actually her chair wrote a letter saying, I'm certifying that this is an accurate representation of the comments that she received. And if anybody wants to see more, they can contact me because it was totally unwieldy to provide an intact set. So in large classes, this can be a problem sometimes. Again, feel free to contact TLS, either Susan Cowan or myself, and we can work through. There are areas now where it's problematic because of the length of the comments that students write.
And Laura, in the guidelines, I believe there is a template that can be used, that professors can use, that can help them to identify
Absolutely.
Kind of the major themes that come out.
There's an analysis worksheet to help provide guidance for people to how to approach the sort of, you know, long list of comments and make some sense of them and help figure out what they're addressing. In many cases, it will actually be one comment 47 times that the students are consistently addressing the same issue, which is very different than 47 different comments about very different aspects of the course.
I'm actually going to add something on a more personal note. This is a wonderful opportunity for you to find mentors, and it's quite often a really wonderful opportunity to find people within your own department who are willing to share information. When I was hired, actually, there were no hires ahead of me for, I think, 12 years, so there was no chance for me to go to somebody and say, hey, how did it feel? And I missed that. So coming through for promotion, it was a real pleasure to be able to be given files from a colleague who'd gone through it before, and then for me to be able to hand my own files to somebody going through the year after me. I mean, obviously we customized for content, but it created a real bond, a network of colleagues, and it made it very easy for me to go and not feel awkward about asking somebody about my career or my research interests, which, as you know, in polite dinner conversation, you're not meant to do. You're meant to listen to the other person's research interests. So it creates a long-term network of colleagues. So if you think of it as a moment in a process, it's actually a very nice moment in a process, the reappointment. And it gives you a chance to test out the kinds of things you're going to be thinking about with the tenure dossier. And it also gives you a chance to test out who will be your group of wise counselors and who will help you both on a collegial and a friendly level. So I think there's a nice way to think about this rather than just thinking about it as this bureaucratic hurdle.
And I think this just elaborates on what Natalie has said, but using it as an opportunity to get feedback, is really important. So create your initial dossier early, take it to people, have them look at it, read it, give you feedback. I think a number of you have suggested it, and we've heard it suggested here, but I think it's really a great opportunity to get that feedback early before you're submitting it for the first time.
Thank you. PowerPoint slides will be posted on the Secretariat webpage when we can get into the James building, which will be online. So, yes, they will be available. Okay.